We are going to dive into one of the most compelling proofs for the supernatural, caught on camera, seen by over a million people in person, today on The Chris Stefanik Show. Welcome to The Chris Stefanik Show. We're here every week to give you the tools and inspiration you need to live your everyday life with joy. If you want daily inspiration, click below this video. Be one of the many people who sign up for the Daily Anchor. We got your back. We want to inspire you to live life to the full, no strings attached. Missionaries of Joy, thank you guys. It's because of you that we're able to do this and all the work that we do to spread the kingdom of God and serve people in need. Sign up to be a Missionary of Joy. Get off the sidelines. Help us out. It's a link below the video. And this episode is sponsored in part by EWTN. You can catch this and so much more on EWTN Plus streaming. Link is below the video. All right, guys, whenever I have a show that brings up something supernatural, for instance, I had an interview with an exorcist a while ago, a lot of the comments I get in the comments field are things like, you know, why isn't this ever captured on film? Why is this kind of supernatural? This miracle you're talking about, Chris, why is this never photographed? Because if it was, then I'd believe. Well, smart aleck, sometimes it is. And today we're going to talk about a miracle that actually was captured, seen by, I think, over a million people. And I have the leading expert to talk to us about it today. He just wrote a book, The Marian Apparitions at Zaytoun, An Evidential Inquiry. If you are a believer, this is going to help you root you in your faith even more. If you're not, I don't even mean to pick on you, keep watching. I dare you to lean into this, be open to what we're about to say, because it might just help tip you over into that realm that, frankly, everybody wants to go to, the belief that life is not a cosmic accident and that there actually is a spiritual realm. Travis Dumsday is a professor of philosophy at Concordia University in Edmonton, author of 4 books that we'll link to. Again, leading expert on Zaytoun. Thank you so much for being with me. It's an honor to have you here.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thanks be to God. Okay, so let's start with this. Tell me what happened. What happened in Zaytoun, this miraculous event that so few people know about?
Yeah, and it's really not all that well known outside of the Coptic community. So basically, so Zaytoun, first of all, is just it's a suburb of Cairo. And on April 2nd, 1968, at St. Mary's Church in Zaytoun, so there used to be a public transit station right across the street from the church. And in the evening on April 2nd, there was a group of Muslim public transit employees just sort of taking a break outside the public transit station on the street. And they noticed a woman who seemed to be in white on the roof of the church, this multi-domed church. And at first they were really kind of concerned. They actually thought this might be like a nun who was about to kill herself, right? Because she's up on the roof of this domed church. This is a highly unusual. And so they start calling for help. You know, they tell the woman, hey, you just stay there. They call the authorities. But as they get a little bit closer and get a more sort of sustained look, they notice that the figure is actually glowing. Mm. This woman in white is emanating this radiant light. And so as they sort of realize this is something unusual, you start to get a crowd forming around the church. The crowd gets larger and larger. You know, the authorities eventually arrive. And then this figure who's glowing on the roof of the church eventually just disappears. And so this was a pretty significant event locally. It attracted a lot of local attention. And then it happened again several nights later. And then it sort of just kept happening at irregular intervals. You know, it was sort of unpredictable. But it was always at night, always atop the roof of the same church. And as news spread throughout the neighborhood and then throughout the wider, you know, neighborhoods in Cairo, you started to get larger and larger crowds assembled every night surrounding this church, to the point where the Egyptian government had to take some serious measures for things like crowd control, because you soon had thousands and thousands of people gathered around this church at night.
This is not just a couple people in a rural village somewhere. Literally, the government's getting involved.
Yeah, the government's getting involved to the point where they actually tore down the public transit station just to make more room for the crowds.
You're kidding me.
No, they tore down the public transit station. They tore down a bunch of the trees surrounding the church to give people a better view. And in the early days, the initial weeks surrounding these events, as the government was trying to get a handle on what was going on, there were initial discussions, well, maybe this is some kind of light trick or some kind of maybe a hoax. So the government tried cutting off power to the whole neighborhood for a while at night to see if that would affect whether this figure was appearing. Had no effect. And we're talking like a 5 to 10 mile radius around the church, right? Just cut off power at
night. You gotta be kidding me.
Nope. The government tried that just to see, again, just try to get a sense of what was going on. And again, but pretty soon though.
Did you know that for just $15 a month, you can change lives? Seriously, $15 a month. That's the cost of a couple lattes. But instead of coffee, you're fueling something eternal. Because of our Missionaries of Joy, our monthly supporters, people are coming back to the church. Families are being strengthened. The gospel is reaching millions. Everything we do, the Chris Stefanik Show, life-changing video series like Living Joy, Rise, Fearless, and Renewed, our live events, it all exists because of people like you. For just $15 a month, you can become part of this mission. And as you participate in this work, we're going to equip you, inspire you, and empower you to live the gospel in your daily life and to help others do the same. When you become a monthly donor, a Missionary of Joy, you're not just donating. You're actually making this mission possible. You're helping us bring hope, truth, and joy to a world that desperately needs it. And that's not all. As a Missionary of Joy, you get exclusive access to all our video series and empowerment to share them in small groups with friends. You get exclusive early access to new releases. You get Monday motivation texts direct from me. And you get access to our daily anchor, daily inspiration to fuel your faith. For less than 50 cents a day, you could bring the joy of the gospel to the world that desperately needs it. Please sign up in the link below this show description. We literally can't do this work without you.
But pretty soon, though, their main concern just became crowd control, right? Because you started to get, again, tens of thousands of people in the early weeks. And then as word spread, Egyptian newspapers estimated that on some nights you had 250,000 people.
A quarter million people?
Yeah, gathered around the church at night.
How long did these apparitions, not for how many years, but when she was there? Is it a couple minutes, a couple hours?
Well, it varied, right? So again, these events are really unpredictable, right? There was no way to tell which night she would appear, which night she wouldn't. And then when she appeared, the mode of her appearance would vary in several different ways. Moreover, the timeline would vary. So sometimes she would appear, this glowing, floating female figure would appear sometimes for like 10, 15 minutes. Other times she'd be there for hours. And especially on those nights that where the apparition was particularly extended, this is one of the reasons why you would get just absolutely massive crowds, right, as word spread and people were able to tell their family and assemble around the church. And so as these events continued, the Egyptian government launched an investigation to try to figure out what was going on. The Coptic Orthodox Patriarchate launched an investigation, an official church inquiry into the apparitions. So the Coptic Pope, Kyrillos VI, sent an official investigatory commission to the apparition site. Several prominent Coptic bishops appointed by him, they saw the apparition as well, which I think is pretty much a first in terms of church, the history of Marian apparitions, right? That a church commission appointed to investigate an apparition actually sees the apparition for themselves. So this went on for quite a while. And now, in the initial months, the apparition was appearing particularly frequently, and the crowds were absolutely massive. As the events continued over the course of a couple of years, gradually the frequency of the apparitions diminished. The crowd sizes gradually diminished. And by summer of 1971, the events had basically ceased.
It's 3 years.
Yeah, 68 through 71, so roughly more like 2.5 years.
Wow.
It was a lengthy series of apparitions, had massive media attention within Egypt and the wider Arab world at the time. It did get some media attention from the international media, so the New York Times did a story on it in summer of 1968. Reuters and some of the other wire services did stories on it. There were some academics on the ground at the time who were writing about it at the time. So it did get a certain amount of coverage, but Not as much as you would expect. Like, if this were to happen again today, presumably in the social media age, it would get a lot more attention.
Yeah. So what were the total number of people who you think saw this live and in person?
Well, it's difficult to estimate, right? Because, I mean, one way you might try to figure this out is just look at, you know, the newspaper and police estimates of crowd sizes on, you know, various nights. But one of the complications is that oftentimes you'd have the same people coming for several nights in a row, right? So how many independent witnesses do you have over the course of these few years? So several Coptic scholars have tried to figure this out, sort of run the numbers. The best estimate I've seen, what I think is a pretty reasonable estimate by a Coptic historian, Daniel Fanu, is probably about 1 million people over the course of that 2+ years. I've seen higher estimates. I've seen somewhat more modest estimates, but I think the estimate by Dr. Fanu is probably pretty reliable.
And sometimes she was alone. Sometimes there was other beings with her.
Yeah, well, so what people were seeing would also vary. So the most prominent sort of famous supernatural or seemingly supernatural phenomenon that was taking place was the apparition itself, right? This glowing, floating, three-dimensional female figure whom everyone, whether Muslim or Copt, identified as the Virgin Mary, right? She was floating atop St. Mary's Church. Other things that were seen, though, so there were other anomalous lights that would sometimes appear, whether in her presence or sometimes just on their own. There were what people described as glowing birds that would appear, sometimes just flying through the air, sometimes flying in a cross formation.
Wow.
Usually the figure would be seen on her own. Occasionally there'd be reports of, you know, she seemed to be carrying a child, or the people identified as the Christ child. But yeah, basically the main phenomena were the figure herself, but then also a variety of other sort of anomalous, luminous phenomena.
I could be mistaken, but the only other apparition I've ever heard about where the general public can see it, not just a few visionaries who would kneel down and look, was Nock. And am I missing any others? I think this is really unique. And it was similar in that Mary just was quiet there. It's just like, I'm here, you're there, we're together.
Yeah, it kind of depends on our definitions, right? So Fatima would be another example of, you know, especially the miracle of the sun, right? Where tens of thousands of people seeing something that seemingly supernatural event. Although with Fatima, it was still only the child visionaries who were actually seeing Mary, right? Yeah. The wider crowd didn't see the apparition itself. They saw this other luminous phenomenon taking place. There are some other reports of large group apparitions of the Virgin Mary. So there was one in, I'm probably going to mispronounce, but Khrushchev, Ukraine, in the 1980s that I don't know much about. There's not all that much published about it in English. Zaytun's not entirely alone in terms of being a supposed mass Marian apparition, but it's by far the largest in terms of the sheer numbers of people involved.
So if you go to a Coptic church today, find an old guy, you go ask him, it's a good chance he was there or heard about it. Like, these people are still around. This is an ancient history.
Oh, sure, this is late 1960s. So if your audience is interested in this and they want to learn more, one easy way to do it is just go to your local Coptic Orthodox church, attend liturgy, obviously be respectful about it, but if you can just, you know, identify some folks in the crowd who are, you know, in their 60s or above and talk to them, chances are if they were in Egypt at the time, they either saw the apparition themselves or they've got close family who did.
That is crazy.
I mean, the sheer numbers involved are such that it is really easy to still find people today who either saw the apparition or had immediate family who witnessed it themselves.
What percentage of people in Egypt at the time or in Zaytun were Muslim? I don't know if you know off the top of your head. I'm just wondering how they received this, how non-Christians received this apparition.
Yeah, good question. So Egypt still today and at the time is about 90% Muslim. And so by far the majority of witnesses at the apparition site were also Muslim. So this is another interesting sort of unique feature of Zaytun, not only in terms of the number of witnesses involved, but the number of non-Christian witnesses who are seeing this.
How do they interpret the theological meaning of this from their perspective? I mean, did they feel challenged by the apparition as non-Christians? Did they think it was Our Lady? Did they think it was a demonic thing? Like, how did they, it seemed like they were open to it.
Well, so it's interesting. So especially 1960s era Egyptian Islam had some devotion themselves to the Virgin Mary, right? The Virgin Mary is mentioned many times in the Quran. She's a revered figure within Islam. But then also, again, in popular Islam in Egypt at the time, she was a highly revered figure. And so, I mean, we might think today, if we think about conflicts between Islam and Christianity, you know, we might today in the West just have the assumption that this would have provoked some conflict, tension. In fact, it did the opposite. It really remarkably brought Muslims and Copts together in a really serious way at a time where that kind of interreligious unity was really badly needed. So if we think about the timeline, 1968 Egypt, this is some months after Egypt had really badly lost in the Six-Day War with Israel.
This is tension.
And in fact, at the time, in spring 1968, there was a really serious situation in Egypt where there was growing Muslim-Coptic tension. Wow. And the reason for that was that Copts were being scapegoated for the war loss. Basically, there were these conspiracy theories floating around that Coptic Christians had betrayed the Egyptian state to Israel and sort of tried to sabotage the war effort internally.
Wow.
It was not true. Coptic soldiers fought on the side of Egypt, just like anybody else in Egypt. But there were these rumors floating around, and there was really seriously rising tensions.
Wow.
And so there was major concerns of a looming serious persecution against the Copts. Mm. And if you look at Coptic history, I mean, the Coptic people are a minority in Egypt, a large minority, but a minority in Egypt. And for the last 1,000 years, they've gone through these waxing and waning periods of persecution, sometimes really horrific persecution. And so that this fear of a looming serious problem were very much legitimate. But then the apparitions happened. And what the apparitions served to do, the effect of the apparitions, maybe this is, people speculate today, maybe this is one of the reasons why the apparitions happened, was it just lowered the temperature and it brought Copts and Muslims together. And for a long period, there not only was there no persecution, but there was a genuine, across Egypt, sort of religious revival.
Wow. Among both faiths.
Yeah, among both faiths, right. So you had this massive revival of monasticism in Egypt after this, so people joining, young people finding monastic vocations. And on the Muslim side, you likewise had, because you know, Egypt was a secular socialist country at the time, and so you did also get this revival of religious interest on the Muslim side as well.
So Our Lady might have literally saved them from a genocide. I mean, that might have been what was looming.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. These historical counterfactuals are always difficult to guess. But yeah, certainly there were really serious concerns at the time, and those concerns, as a direct consequence of the apparitions, those concerns evaporated. For a time.
Maybe she needs to come do this again. But honestly, if it happened, I was thinking, if it happened today, we have so much crazy technology that I think a lot of people would dismiss it as, this is some new drone flying around looking like the doves around her. There's some new holographic technology. There's something providential in the fact that it happened then, to where it might almost be dismissed if it happened now, right? It might make the rounds on social and... But wow. What other meaning have people derived from this? I don't know if what does it speak to you? I can see the historic significance and maybe what she spared people from, the unity of peoples. What other spiritual reflections on frankly, the Muslim and the Coptic side have come out of this?
What were
they thinking it meant back then?
Well, back then, so the general message that the Egyptian people seemed to take at the time was one of sort of spiritual strengthening, spiritual comfort at a time when the Egyptian economy was in tatters. You know, they were recovering from this horrible, from their perspective, this horrible war loss, right? Huge casualty numbers. And so from their side, it was sort of, well, Jesus' mother is coming to comfort and, you know, support the Egyptian people in their time of need. And that's one reason I think why the Muslim population was sort of on board with this. They saw it as providential as well.
Wow.
And so, but of course, there's, on the Coptic side, there's also the idea that, well, this is not only preventing the persecution, but, you know, strengthening the church.
Wow.
And there were, now this is not widely talked about, and especially at the time, this was a really sensitive subject, but we know today that there were definitely some Islamic conversions to Coptic Orthodoxy as a result of these apparitions. You know, they weren't widely talked about. They weren't publicized. Obviously, the Coptic Church wasn't going to publicize this, but secretly, there were definitely some conversions going on at the time.
You know, it does, when you think of Mary appearing to people in their hour of need, that really does sync up with Knock. Well, I love the Knock imagery, that she appears there to a people who are impoverished, potato famine, and they just look at each other. I mean, this is the way to be for people who are suffering, right? Just, you don't know what to say. Sometimes you show up and say, I'm here.
Right.
We'll sit together. We'll sit together in the pain. Heaven hasn't forgotten you. That's profoundly beautiful. I want to rip through some of the objections to this. And it amazes me that the world hasn't paid more attention to it, or that I don't hear this in Catholic or Christian apologetics or arguments for the existence of the supernatural. Why do you think it hasn't gotten more press, even among Christians? Because there's going to be devout Christians watching me and Catholics watching me who haven't even heard of Zaytun.
Yeah, well, it's a good question why this isn't more widely known. You know, I think part of it is just the fact that the Coptic people are a minority, not only within Egypt, but of course, you know, the Coptic Orthodox Church is a relatively small part of, you know, the global Orthodox communion. So it might just be that they're, you know, if this is seen, for better or worse, if this is seen as a Coptic event, it's maybe not going to get as much attention in other Christian bodies or other Christian denominations.
Okay.
That might be part of it. Part of it also might just be that a lot of what's been written on this, a lot of the media coverage of this was in Arabic. You know, there has been a fair bit written on this in the years since, but that may also have been just a lack of... There wasn't as much English language media coverage of the event at the time as one would as there ought to have been.
Well, again, get the book. Link in the show notes, because this is this kind of thing, and this interview hopefully changes that. Right? We have the ability to change that. Marian apparitions at Zaytun, an evidential inquiry. Phenomenal. Share this link with friends. Okay, so to the objections. I want to go through your responses to the naturalistic explanations of this. Before we do, Hume's argument against miracles in general is one of the better arguments I've heard against miracles. I obviously don't agree with him, but it's you know, just basically saying that the chances of people getting something wrong or hallucinating, even if they're well-intentioned, are far greater than the number of miracles that people could claim even happened. Therefore, every single time someone claims a miracle, it's more rational to say, well, this is just people getting it wrong. How do you respond to that?
Yeah. So Hume's got several arguments against believing people's miracle testimony, right? And yeah, and exactly. One of his core arguments is from how we weigh probabilities, right? And so if we start off thinking that a miraculous event is going to be highly improbable, well, then it may just be that however seemingly compelling the testimony you're faced with, it's always going to be more likely that the person is somehow getting it wrong or that they're lying than that the miracle actually took place, right? And so if you start off with the assumption that miracles either they just don't happen or that the probability of their occurrence is just astronomically low, then when you weigh the probabilities, you'll just say, well, it's always going to be more likely that this testimony should be distrusted.
Yeah.
Now, there's very, you know, philosophers have been talking about Hume's Hume's argument for a long, long time. One kind of concern you might have, sort of a commonly discussed concern, is that Hume is sort of just begging the question, right? If you start off with the assumption that miracles don't happen or that they're astronomically improbable, well, of course, that's going to affect how you assess the evidential value of miracle testimony.
Right.
On the flip side, if you're open-minded to the occurrence of the miraculous, you're going to assess that testimony differently. And why not be open-minded, right? Why not take the testimony seriously? Why not at least be open to the idea that these things may occur? at least if what we're doing is seeking the truth in an objective, unbiased fashion, then you probably don't want to start off with the assumption that these things just don't happen or that their occurrence is going to be astronomically improbable, because then, of course, you're going to be dismissive of people's testimony, right?
Yeah.
If I think that, by analogy, if I think that the existence of leprechauns is astronomically improbable, I'm not going to accept your testimony to having interacted with a leprechaun, no matter how much I trust your character. I'm going to assume that you were undergoing some kind of psychotic break or something weird was going on, right? So should we think of miraculous events in general as having the same status as something like a leprechaun sighting? Well, if you're Richard Dawkins, sure, they're all equally crazy, right?
Yeah.
And depending on one's background beliefs, maybe it does make sense to think of miracles as just as improbable as something like that. But I think for most people, even for most atheists and agnostics and people committed to a kind of metaphysical naturalism, the belief that the only kind of reality is physical reality, I think even most people with those commitments are going to say that, well, they're not inclined to believe in the miraculous, but they're probably also not completely closed to the idea.
Mm.
And if you're not completely closed to the idea, then I think Hume's argument just doesn't go through. Because if you're willing to grant that the reality of that miraculous events might have some level of evidence to them, well, then why not look at the evidence?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how a lot of atheists think that they have the high ground of just bringing purely objective reality to their assessment of everything, including miracle claims like this. And they're sometimes just like any dogmatic believer, they're bringing preconceived notions into their how they assess what you're claiming, and they're imposing those things. So that's a great way to counter Hume's argument. Yeah, but the large percent of atheists and agnostics, and maybe some of you guys are watching, who are open to the possibility of, this really helps people lean in. Because it's not, I think there's an openness because there's also a hope, right? I mean, if I get comments from atheists on our videos, and I love you guys, thanks for commenting, I'm thinking, why are you watching? Well, yes, you're not committed to the atheism, because I'm not watching atheist videos, because I don't want them to be right, to be totally frank, right? And it's good to hear what they have to say and be able to respond to it. But I think sometimes they're watching because they want a breakthrough, because who doesn't want there to be a spiritual realm? And who doesn't want for us to have a soul and the hope of some kind of eternal paradise? So all these responses that you give to the naturalistic claims are just telling people, come on in. Here's your excuse to lean into the thing that you hope is actually true. All right, so let's go through some of these. And you did a great job, man, really diving in. Okay, the tectonic strain theory. What is that? How do they try to explain away these apparitions with the tectonic strain theory, and how do you respond?
Sure, yeah. So what I do in the book is, the first few chapters are just giving a history of the events and going through a whole variety of eyewitness testimonies just to give people a sample of what people were actually seeing, give them a good clear idea of that. But then the second half of the book is mostly focused on just going through all of the scientific explanations that scholars have put forward trying to account for these events in naturalistic terms, right? Mm-hmm. And trying to figure out, well, how convincing are those explanations? And what I claim is that at least up till now, none of those scientific explanations work very well. And the first one that I consider, and the one that I consider really in the most detail, because it's, I think, at least at first glance, the most promising a potential naturalistic explanation, is this theory developed by a Canadian neuroscientist, Michael Persinger, and it's called, as you say, tectonic strain theory. His basic idea was that it's a combination of a geological theory and a neuroscientific theory.
Hmm.
And so his theory combines these two fields in a certain way. And so the geological part of the theory is basically what he says is that we are constantly surrounded by our ambient environment, right? The environment we're living in, we're constantly surrounded by electromagnetic waves. And the frequency of those electromagnetic waves is affected by a variety of environmental stimuli, including geological stimuli, right? Huh. So tectonic strain can actually affect certain things going on in our ambient electromagnetic environment. That can also literally spark anomalous lights. So this is part of his explanation.
Boy, this sounds like grasping at straws. I'm sorry, doesn't it?
Well, so there is a real well-confirmed phenomena known as earthquake lights. So when a really severe earthquake happens, you can get flashes of light in the environment because tectonic strain really can affect the ambient electromagnetic environment.
So he really thought this could make an image appear looking like a woman over the course of 2.5 years in front of 250,000 people. Like,
basically.
Did he actually think that?
Well, so let me flesh out his.
I don't want to undignify his argument.
Just so I don't look like, you know, I don't want us to straw man it, right?
Yeah,
so,
I hear you.
So just to flesh his theory out a little bit further. So the idea is that this electromagnetic strain in the environment can give rise to objectively real weird lights in the sky, right? Okay. That are just being sparked by these geological events, right? Now, we know that severe earthquakes really can do that. They can give rise to momentary flashes of light in the environment. What's more controversial is whether lower levels of geological activity can do the same. Persinger posited that maybe it could. It's not so clear in geology. The other part of his theory is that a certain portion of the population have what he referred to as temporal lobe lability. So the temporal lobe is a certain region of the brain. The theory is that the temporal lobe can be involved in certain forms of hallucination. And his theory was that the temporal lobes are particularly vulnerable to changes in your ambient electromagnetic environment.
Okay.
So here's how the theory works then, right? That you get these changes in geological activity, right? Shifts in tectonic plates, et cetera. That geological activity gives rise to these various changes in the electromagnetic environment, and those changes in the electromagnetic environment do two things, right? They can spark these weird luminous phenomena in the sky, and simultaneously they cause a certain proportion of the population to hallucinate.
Okay.
So how does this work with UFO sightings, for example? Here's how Persinger applies this to UFO sightings. So if somebody claims that they have a UFO sighting and they see the ship land and weird beings come out, how does Persinger explain this? Well, he says what's going on is that such an individual is, it might have started out they're seeing a real light in the sky.
Yeah.
And their brain is particularly vulnerable to these environmental changes. And so they start having a hallucination. Given their cultural background, they see the weird light, they start hallucinating. What do they hallucinate? Well, in the modern 20th century, maybe they hallucinate a flying saucer and they hallucinate weird beings, right? And so this is how Persinger explains UFO sightings, right, by reference to this theory. Maybe in a different cultural environment, rather than seeing a flying saucer, they might see a religious vision, right?
Okay.
And so he takes this theory and he basically, in this scientific paper he published in 1989 with a colleague, John Darren, it was published in a legitimate, a peer-reviewed psychology journal. The theory was that Egypt at the time was experiencing an unusually high level of tectonic strain, and that this tectonic strain gave rise to precisely these environmental conditions, and so a certain proportion of the population started when these luminous phenomena were taking place, a certain portion of the population started hallucinating. What were they hallucinating? In a predominantly Muslim and Christian context, they were hallucinating the Virgin Mary.
Wow. So it feels like people accuse us of God of the gaps. You don't have an explanation, we insert God. This feels like a scientism of the gaps. We don't have an explanation. We try to insert science. Well, what's your response to that argument?
One of the interesting things about tectonic strain theory was that it was a genuine attempt to explain group paranormal experiences, right? Mm. Because most neuroscientific explanations of religious and paranormal experiences are, of course, going to just be explaining things in terms of what's going on in one person's brain.
Yeah.
This is trying to explain, well, how is it you might get a group of people who claim to be experiencing the same thing at the same time? Assuming this theory might have some efficacy for explaining certain kinds of paranormal phenomena, like UFO sightings or something, how well does it explain Zaytun? So that's one question I ask. And then I ask another question, well, okay, what is the scientific status today of tectonic strain theory? How well does it hold up in the current scientific literature? So in answer to the first question, right, assuming this is potentially scientifically viable, how well does it explain Zaytun? I argue that it does not explain it very well, in part for some of the reasons you were just alluding to, right?
Yeah.
Even if this works for other kinds of paranormal phenomena, how does this explain, why are these lights appearing only above this one church? Why are, if it's only supposed to be a certain percentage of the population that have these vulnerable temporal lobes, why do you get tens of thousands of people experiencing the same thing at the same time surrounding this church, right? It just doesn't seem to account for the data in the way that the theory would really need to.
And the photos.
And the photos, right. You know, how, right, exactly. If the photos are genuine, it likewise, you know, the photos are not just of amorphous blobs of light. Some of them are, but some of them are photographs of seemingly more defined figures, like the one that's reproduced on the cover of the book. So I think that even if the theory were viable for other kinds of paranormal phenomena, it would not explain Zaytoun. Okay. Then the question is the theory actually scientifically viable? And I argue that no, it's not. If you look at the neuroscience literature, especially the last 15 years, basically what people have found is that, so Persinger did a lot of lab experiments trying to demonstrate this, right? That if you, he developed this special, the media labeled it the God helmet, right? You put this special helmet on people's heads that subjects them to certain forms of electromagnetic activity, put them in a sensory deprivation chamber. Persinger claimed that a certain percentage of people are going to start having dramatic hallucinations. Wow. But basically, neuroscientists have not been able to replicate his results. It just seems as if ambient electromagnetic activity does not actually prompt hallucinations.
Wow.
In anybody.
Wow. Okay. Well, slam dunk on that, right?
Yeah.
Mass hallucinations.
Yeah. So this is the idea that, so leaving aside this more complicated sort of background idea about what might exactly be sparking these sorts of things. So the sort of more generic idea is that, well, maybe just when you've got loads of people, a large crowd in the same place, maybe if they're all amped up and emotional, maybe you just start getting a whole ton of people hallucinating. And if they're from the same cultural background, maybe they're going to be hallucinating, you know, roughly similar things. Maybe that's what's going on at Zaytoun. I argue in response to that idea that, well, first off, the notion of mass hallucinations is not a recognized notion in psychology, right? Mm. This idea that you can get thousands of people at the same place at the same time seeing what they claim to be the same thing, and this is explained by subjective psychological factors, this is just not a thing in psychology. Mm. There is no theory in modern psychology to account for this or put this forward. In fact, I wish I'd been able to include the reference in the book, but there's a Harvard psychologist, Tim Lomas, who's written on exactly this issue just in the last couple of years. And Lomas points out that the notion of a mass hallucination is just not a recognized idea in psychology. Mm. There is no psychological theory of mass hallucinations of the kind one would need to account for something like this. So that's one problem. The other problem is that if you really dig into the eyewitness testimonies, what you find is that when we say that, well, people were seeing the same thing at the same time, we don't just mean that in a generic sense, that they're seeing a light atop the church. No, they're seeing, and you can show this because they have interviews of people who are, you know, experiencing the same thing at the same time on the same night, right? And down to pretty fine details, people in the crowd were seeing the same thing, right? This just does not fit in with what you would need in a mass hallucination explanation, right? Because if it's a mass hallucination, right, you're going to expect significant differences in detail, right? If we're, even if we have the same cultural background such that we're both seeing an angel, right?
Yeah.
Maybe for you, the angel's wearing a red sash, and for me, the angel's wearing a blue sash, right? Mm. Or that there's differences in detail, in significant detail that you would expect. Because it's still subjectively generated hallucinations, right? You would not expect us to be literally seeing the same exact thing. And we know from examining the eyewitness reports that we can show to a pretty high degree of confidence, people were actually seeing the same thing at the same time.
Wow. And a lot of these can be answered too with there's photos. Yeah, it's amazing how, I mean, people have done serious work to try to debunk this from all these different angles, because it drives home the fact that this is a serious challenge to the entire atheistic worldview, right? I mean, they're invested in trying to undermine this if they want to hang on to that worldview, which, again, I don't know why anyone would really want to. That's another episode. But there's a drive here behind this, you know, really trying to grasp at straws sometimes. The Jungian analytic physiology.
Yeah, so this, I think, is actually a more interesting theory. So there's a scholar, Valeria Cespedes Musso, who came out with a book just a few years ago, a couple of years before mine, on Zeitun, and what she's trying to do is explain the apparitions by reference to Jungian analytical psychology. So in the book, I try to provide, as best I can, a kind of summary of some of the core Jungian ideas that she's referencing as part of the theory, and then I sort of summarize how she applies that to Zeitun, and then try to provide a kind of critical assessment. In a nutshell, to try to just do this very briefly, so Carl Jung had this theory of the collective unconscious, right? Mm-hmm. So in psychoanalysis generally, there's this notion that all of us, you know, our minds are divided into these different components or aspects, right? The subconscious versus our conscious minds, etc. And Jung thought that not only do we have sort of an individual unconscious, we also have a collective unconscious in the sense that all human beings share some deeply ingrained universal, what he referred to as archetypes, right? These psychological constructs present in the minds of everyone. So we all have some shared content in what he refers to as this collective unconscious. And those archetypes have associated imagery. And so Jung had this notion that when people have hallucinations, usually what's going on is that due to various psychological pressures or difficulties in people's lives, some of those internal archetypes get sort of transitioned from the unconscious mind into the conscious mind, right? Due to psychological pressures, psychological difficulties, the unconscious mind is basically, it's under pressure, it then pushes contents out into the conscious mind. And this gives rise to hallucinations. And so Jung had a theory of UFO sightings, flying saucers, where he took this idea of the collective unconscious and thought that, well, so on Jung's theory of archetypes, the circle or the sphere is supposed to be a symbol of, I think for him it was a symbol of life. And so Jung's thought was that, well, the reason why you've got thousands of people reporting flying saucer sightings is that everyone's afraid of nuclear annihilation, right? He wrote this book in the 1950s. Everyone's afraid of nuclear annihilation, and so we've all got these shared psychological archetypes. The sphere is an archetype of life. We're all afraid of losing our lives. We're under psychological pressure. We're hallucinating saucers. That was basically Jung's idea about what's going on with flying saucer sightings. I'm oversimplifying this, but that's a general idea. So Musso takes Jung's theory of UFO sightings and seeks to apply it to group Marian apparitions, where she thinks that in Egypt in the 1960s, there were, of course, other psychological pressures going on, and the nature of those psychological pressures were causing other archetypes to be transitioned into the conscious mind with their associated symbolism. A lot of those archetypes had to do with female imagery. And she has an explanation. She explains this in terms of Egyptian patriarchy at the time and pressures on male-female relationships, etc., in addition to just the more obvious pressures of, you know, the post-war economic collapse, etc. So she thinks that the reason why you had large numbers of people not only having a shared apparition, but a shared apparition of a female figure was these Jungian archetypes getting, again, just in a state of shared psychological pressure. Those archetypes are being brought up into the conscious mind, and people were having these sort of shared hallucinations.
You're a very patient man. I mean, some of these arguments, again, I just, my instant, almost visceral response is, 250,000 people seeing the same exact thing and there's pictures of it. Come on, you know, you're, what are you guys doing? But really, the patience of, let's hear you, let's wade through the argument, and let's give it a calm response, picking it apart. That's a good example for me about how to respond to some of these things. Because, again, I think some of it is coming from, they're imposing their worldview, which I think is purely objective. But maybe it comes from wounds or the problems with a father figure. I don't know where it's coming from, with a father figure or some reason to not want to believe, to want to hold on to skepticism and perceiving that as safe. But yeah, thanks for doing that. Thanks for going through the pains of spelling all this out. This one, I think, would be the one where most, you know, maybe Gen Zers would go, because they know how to doctor up a photo. The amount of things we could do now that we couldn't do in 1968, it's crazy. The idea that this was a technological hoax. What are the claims there, and how do you respond to that one? How do you know this wasn't just somebody who had a lot of money, who brought in a power generator, who had an advanced way of making a hologram that we didn't find out about? How do you respond to that one?
Yeah, and in fact, if I were myself trying to provide some kind of naturalistic explanation for this, this is the one I think I would try to go for, some kind of technologically generated hoax, because I think that's the only way you'd be able to have this kind of shared vision with the sheer number of people we're dealing with. And so, and this is a bit tricky, though, because there's not really been a well-developed, like, scholarly theory about how this might have worked. And so I'm kind of just sort of spitballing, trying to figure out, well, how would someone try to make this argument, right? Mm-hmm. One idea might be, well, maybe someone was just, like, shining a spotlight. Two-dimensional image projection, right? The problem with that would be, well, then you'd be able to very quickly see where the projection was coming from, right? It would be very obvious pretty quickly that this would be an artificially generated image. Moreover, eyewitnesses, and again, in the book I provide a lot of examples of eyewitness testimonies that were published at the time, and people are adamant, this is a three-dimensional figure, right? This is not an image projection, right? Yeah. This is a lifelike, moving figure that's gesturing at the crowds. It's moving from one part of the church roof to the other, right? So not something you would expect from a two-dimensional image projection coming from a single direction, right?
And if there was a way to do that, Disney would have figured it out by now, and you'd be seeing this when you visit. I mean, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing remotely like that now. A walking, three-dimensional hologram. Yeah, we can't do that in 2025.
Well, yeah. So the other natural explanation we might try to suggest today would be holography, right?
Holography.
And the issue, so what I point out in the book.
What is that?
So just holograms, right? Okay. And so what I point out in the book is that, you know, again, this started in 1968. At that point, scientists had literally just developed holograms a couple of years earlier. So this is brand new technology, certainly not available in Egypt. Moreover, even today, holograms are stationary, right? Mm. Even a hologram can't move. Whereas this image that people were seeing in Zeitoun was often described as, again, moving intelligibly, gesturing to the crowd, doing things. So this is definitely not any kind of hologram that we're familiar with today. So the only way, I mean, one could try to push maybe the idea that someone was working with some kind of secret technology that we still haven't made public today, but I could imagine someone really pushed up against the wall might try to claim, well, maybe the U.S. government developed 3D holograms in the 1960s and they wanted to try it out somewhere. But I can't imagine what the motivation would be for doing that in Egypt. So what I suggest in the book is that we don't have any good technological explanation for what people were actually seeing. And we certainly don't, in 1960s Egypt, we have no good candidates. Not only that, but even if the technology were available, what I argue is that there were no good suspects or who would have been perpetrating the hoax. The Egyptian government had no motivation to do something like this. The Coptic Church, I argue, had no rational motivation for trying to pull something like this. The risks would have just been insane to try to pull something like that. So even if there were technology that would be available that could feasibly do something like this, I think there are no good suspects for someone who might be trying to
perpetrate. No one would have compelling reason to keep that technology secret 50 years later still. You know? I mean, it definitely would be seeing Disney princesses hologram 3D. Everybody who could make a buck off it would be using that technology. My mind's really blown here. I mean, this is as close to proof of the supernatural as we find God dropping hints of throughout history. I mean, the Shroud of Turin is pretty dang compelling. But this is really, this is up there with any other proofs. And yet, proofs and reasons don't equate to faith. I mean, some people have a hard time. They get frustrated with a loved one who leaves the faith. And, hey, don't they get it? I'm laying out the arguments, you know. And that misses the point of what faith is. Faith is relational. It requires an act of will, much like marriage. I can get why this person is the right person to marry. That doesn't equate to me producing a ring. That has, my will has to move my heart, my life to surrender to the person, right? That's why I think of, God bless him, Jordan Peterson. He won't say I'm a believing Christian, but he will say I'm someone who gets it. Those are two different things. You know, you debate atheists. I mean, I'm grateful for you. I mean, you have a brilliant intellect and the right spirit to enter into these kind of dialogues with the most hardened non-believer. And you lay out these proofs, these reasons. What do you think keeps people from budging? Because I've watched some of your debates with atheists. They're not winning, you know. But they don't say, okay, uncle, you know, you're right. I'm therefore believing. Where do they tend to dig their heels in at the end of the argument and walk away saying, okay, it's cool, but I still don't believe?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think one way to, to put it charitably, so let's say we've given someone a genuinely compelling argument for some truth of the faith, maybe a really good argument for the existence of God or for the resurrection of Christ or something like this, and they decline to believe. Now we might, one thing I think we really should be careful not to do is automatically attribute, well, they've got bad motives, or you know, they want to continue in their life of sin or something like this, and so they don't want to believe. No, I think oftentimes it's a matter of, especially like an atheist who's really given it a lot of thought, who's rationally gone through arguments for both sides, and they're genuinely convinced of their atheism. They might find, for example, the problem of evil to be just rationally devastating to theism. And so they might, for example, think that the reality of evil is so obviously incompatible with the reality of God that no matter how good your argument for the resurrection of Christ, or no matter how good the argument for the supernatural nature of some Marian apparition, they're going to say, look, nevertheless, a priori, right, looking at this from stepping back for a moment, the probability that God is real is just so massively unlikely that just trumps all this other evidence, right? Now, in my opinion, that's ultimately not the right stance to take, right? Because I think the problem of evil, there are some reasonable ways of trying to deal with it philosophically, or whatever that their background objection might be. Right, I'd be inclined to say that probably there are good ways of trying to deal with whatever their rational block is. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, so if we're charitable, we assume there is some rational motivation for being resistant to some of the best arguments or evidence being put forward, I would say, well, it's probably they've got a belief about their background evidence, where the background evidence is such that belief in the supernatural or belief in God is just, it's irrational. So no matter how good the evidence might be on the other side, they have reasons they believe for thinking that the other position, that theism is just not the way to go. Now, the only way I think, so if their motivations for rejecting theism and rejecting this evidence are genuinely rational, well, of course, then there's hope, right? Because...
you could go down the other rabbit holes with them.
Well, yeah, you can chip away, right? You can say...
Keep talking.
Yeah, you can... If their motivations for rejecting belief in God or belief in Christianity are rational motivations, there's always room then to sort of chip away and try to show, well, okay, so you think that the problem of evil is absolutely decisive. Explain to me why you think the problem of evil is so decisive. And then you can go through and try to show, well, is it so decisive? If you can sort of chip away at that, maybe they'll be more open to other lines of evidence. Mm-hmm. So I think to be charitable, you know, to those whose objections to the faith are genuinely rationally based, well, then there's always hope, right? Because there's always, we can always dig further into those reasons. I think Christianity is a rational belief system, and so I think there's always going to be a way to move people if their objections are genuinely based in philosophy or in reason in some way.
Great. So you've given us good arguments to defend Zaytoun, but also a good example for how to enter into dialogue with the most hardened atheist who may be a family or friend. And maybe it's you watching, right? George Wald's quote really strikes me. He's a famous atheist, and he said, 400 years ago, there was a collection of molecules named Shakespeare, which produced Hamlet. That's really a disturbing line, isn't it? But it's very consistent with an atheistic worldview, that if there's no God and there's no soul, then we are just rational space sludge that happened to be lucky enough to be here, and we're going to be destined for nothing. And again, this is why one of the biggest reasons most people still believe, because we don't want that to be true. And when people lay out proofs like you have in this book, again, get it, The Marian Apparitions at Zaytun, it gives you permission to, again, lean into to what you hope is true. And if you're kind of on the fence and you've made a name for yourself as the family atheist that shows up at parties and fights people, can I just give you permission to just be wrong? It's okay. It's okay. I do it in fights with my wife all the time. Hey, I was wrong. And just get a new identity for yourself, one that maybe makes you happier. And if you have faith, you know, I hope this built you up and gave you more reasons to lean into the faith that you have and just rest in the reality of all this, of all the hope and cause for joy that we have, that human existence is not an accident, and we're actually intended and destined for glory and not just these space dust floating through the cosmos destined for nothingness. This is really good news. So what you're sharing here is really good news. Makes faith just an easier thing for people to jump into. But it really does boil down to not just enough proofs, but an act of the will. At some point, you got to make a choice.
Well, just one other thing, just to piggyback off that for a moment, that this is probably a controversial claim, but I'm inclined to think that as the church moves forward in the next several decades, I think that... So it's important to carry on our dialogue with atheism, with agnosticism, kind of naturalism. But I think the real, and in fact, the book is largely just trying to make an argument for the reality of the supernatural. So I get that dialogue with atheism and naturalism is really important to keep engaging in. But I think the bigger threat is just coming from a different angle. Whereas, so for those of us engaged in Christian philosophy and Christian apologetics, I think... the younger generation is much less enamored with atheism than they were a couple of decades ago, right? The so-called 100%. New atheism, I think, is gradually declining.
Yeah.
The students I am engaging with in my own teaching and whatnot, I think that by and large, although they're not belonging to any particular religion, they're not atheists and they're not naturalists. They're very open to some kind of supernatural reality, but...
gives me hope thinking of that.
Yeah, although they're looking at the wrong kinds of supernatural reality, right? I think the main sparring partner, I think, that Christian thinkers are going to be engaging with over the next several decades is not going to be atheists and agnostics. I think it's going to be New Agers. I think it's going to be people who are... Anyway, I realize that's a controversial claim, but I think that this is something the church needs to prepare for. I think we need to be prepared to engage with a much wider range of other supernaturalist perspectives on reality that are nevertheless still not Christian.
Yeah, that's a great insight, especially from a guy who spends his life teaching kids. Now that I'm nearing 50.
You seem like kids. Yeah.
People in their 20s are suddenly kids.
Yeah.
I'm not getting older. They're just getting younger. Right. Thanks for engaging them. And that does give me hope. I think it was G.K. Chesterton said that if you don't believe in one of the great world religions, if you don't believe in an established religion, you end up believing anything. Mm-hmm. So you get into these vague forms of, quote, spirituality, spiritual, not religious. And yeah, that's a good thing to keep in mind. We've got to invite them to a personal Lord. Thank you for doing this.
Oh, thank you for having me. Yeah.
Thanks. You're a great witness. And I just... thoroughly enjoy this, man. You're a brilliant mind, and thanks for what you do. Thanks for writing this book. Thank you guys for watching. I love you, and we will see you next time.